morning and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm Carol Van Dam in Washington, and here are some of the stories making news across South Sudan and around the region this Tuesday, October 31st, 2023. A humanitarian group has recovered dozens of bodies around Sudan's South Darfur state.
We are currently within the military headquarters collecting all the dead bodies that are left lying on the ground. Our wish is that God would help us to offer this service to our late brothers.
And some South Sudanese are heading back to Sudan despite the ongoing fighting between two warring military factions.
They say we could not add suffering to another situation. Some of them have gone back and some are planning to follow those who left.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. The Sudanese Red Crescent Society in South Darfur state says it has collected more than 40 bodies in and around Niala town over the past 5 days after heavy fighting this past week between the Sudan Armed Forces and the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces. A health official with the group confirms that a large number of soldiers with the army look to have been killed. Michael Atit reports for VOA from Juba.
Officials with the Sudanese Red Crescent Society in South Darfur state say bodies were scattered in and around the Army's 16th Infantry Division headquarters in Niala. As-Sanusi Muhammad As-Sanusi, the health coordinator at the Sudanese Red Crescent Society in South Darfur state, says his team is preparing to collect more bodies in Niala for what he describes as a dignified manner.
We are currently within the military headquarters collecting all the dead bodies that are left lying on the ground. Our wish is that God would help us to offer this service to our late brothers.
Muhammad says most of the dead bodies are SAF soldiers who were killed on Thursday last week after the paramilitary Rapid Support Forces, or RSF, seized control of the Army's 16th Infantry Division headquarters in Niala.
If these dead bodies are not collected urgently, it may lead to other disasters. As we are approaching summer season, there are fears that if these dead bodies remain for more days, that would create a lot of environmental and health issues in the town.
Muhammad says most of the dead bodies are in military uniform, while a few are in civilian clothes. He adds that his team could not identify some of the bodies. Isa Dafala, a volunteer with the Red Crescent Society in Niala, says his team buried some of the bodies without identifying them due to a lack of information.
After 1 or 2 days, features of a dead body would change. So if we don't find any identification in their pockets, it will be challenging to identify them. Some are buried without identifying their features.
Dafala says most of the volunteers have fled the town and is calling on both the SAV and the RSF to respect the international law of war. He says the presence of decomposed bodies in Niala town may lead to more health and environmental problems.
It may lead to the spread of chronic diseases, such as cholera, among other dangerous diseases. Unfortunately, we are facing this challenging situation amidst a shortage of proper health system in the state. This is a serious disaster for our people.
Fighting between SAV and the RSF erupted on April 15 following disagreements over the integration of the paramilitary group into the National Army. The fighting has devastated Khartoum's capital and sparked what some Sudanese analysts called ethnically driven attacks in the Darfur region. The nearly 7 months of fighting have left more than 9,000 people killed and another 5.6 million forced to flee their homes, according to the United Nations. Muhammad As-Sunusi's audio was provided by Saleh Abu Alama, a local journalist in Niala town. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
Dozens of South Sudanese who recently returned home from Sudan due to the fighting there reportedly are going back because of the humanitarian crisis in their own country. But South Sudan's humanitarian affairs minister denies returnees are going back across the border. Leith Nyakjok has this report for VOA from Bentiu.
John Toria, a manager and coordinator of the UN-run Protection of Civilian or POC side in the United States capital Bentiu, say some returnees who resettled in the camp have left for the South Sudan-Sudan border due to lack of food and other basic necessity in United States.
I'm aware of returnees who came to us. When they got us here suffering, they say we could not add suffering to another situation. Some of them have gone back and some are planning to follow those who left.
Toad say the returnees are going back to Rang and Songo transit camp near the South Sudan-Sudan border. Angelina Nyatabakul, a blog leader at the Bentiu IDP camp, say 60 returnees whom he accommodated in her blog left the camp in August after they arrived from Sudan.
They say this cannot be divided into two. That is why they go back. And we know this cannot be divided into two. In my home block, I accommodate 60 returnees. I give them two rooms, which I build because they have no relative in the block. They left in August. The situation forced them.
Long Riangatke say the returnees who want to go back to Sudan have no means of transport and some have to walk without any food supply and cash.
When fighting happened in Khartoum, many people returned home. And now that they are being forced by hunger and they have all gone back, some of them are dying along the way while footing. Some are using manga going back to Rang and Tongor. Some have gone back to Khartoum. But what is forcing them is hunger.
So Sudan Humanitarian Affairs Minister Albina Akolatak denied returnees are going back to Sudan. He said the returnees who are facing challenges in their village can make individual decisions.
When they ran from Sudan, it was a conflict, we know. And here, this is their home. If there is any difficulties, I think this is not the decision of that can be generalized.
A majority of the returnees in the United States have complained about lack of food, health facilities, clean drinking water, access to education, and measles outbreak since they arrived in the area. For VOA News, I'm Lee Nyajua in Bentiu, United States.
The World Health Organization warns that disease outbreaks, malnutrition, and non-communicable diseases are rising in war-torn Sudan with devastating consequences for millions of people. Lisa Schlein has more for VOA from Geneva.
Since conflict erupted April 15th, more than 4.6 million people have become displaced inside Sudan. This number, added to the more than 3 million who already were displaced within the country before the conflict, makes Sudan home to the world's largest internally displaced crisis. The World Health Organization warns the health system in Sudan is stretched to the breaking point and does not have the capacity to deal with the mounting health needs afflicting this enormous, vulnerable population. WHO representative in Sudan, Nima Saeed Abid, speaking from Port Sudan today, says health care is limited. Because of insecurity, he says 70-80% of health facilities are non-functional in conflict hotspots. He told journalists that displacement and shortages of medicines and medical supplies are placing millions of Sudanese at risk of severe illness or death from preventable and treatable causes.
Mass displacement have driven the population further into a state of widespread malnutrition, with the lives of children hanging in the balance. Cholera, measles, dengue, and malaria are circulating in several states, and a combination of any of these with severe acute malnutrition can be lethal.
WHO reports 3.4 million Sudanese children under 5 are acutely malnourished, and 700,000 are suffering from severe acute malnutrition, which can lead to death. Abid says outbreaks of cholera have been declared in Gedaref, Khartoum, and South Kordofan states, with suspected cases reported from Al Jazeera and Kassal states.
And there is possibility of further expansion because of the quality of water supply, because of the sanitation, and because of displacement, and the healthcare system in Sudan now is really at the breaking point. So for all these reasons, we are expecting that we may see more state affected, more people affected.
As of last week, WHO reports 1,962 suspected cholera cases, with 30 lab-confirmed cases and 72 associated deaths. It estimates more than 3.1 million people are at risk of cholera until the end of December. Abid says WHO has deployed 14 rapid response teams into the affected areas. He says WHO has stockpiled drugs and essential supplies for the treatment of cholera patients and is getting ready to receive oral cholera vaccines. Lisa Schlein, VOA News, Geneva.
As South Sudan commemorates the International Day for Disaster Risk Reduction, some South Sudanese affected by flooding are asking the government to create a special emergency fund to be able to respond to humanitarian disasters such as floods whenever they happen. One victim of flooding is urging the government to educate communities in areas prone to flooding about how to mitigate the impact of such disasters. Viola Elias reports for VOA from Juba.
28-year-old Amor Tabi, a survivor of flooding in Jonglei State, says her family lost property during last year's flooding. She says people affected by recent floods are finding it difficult to rebuild their lives.
So it was really very difficult for people like us, and it really affected us. Starting from scratch again for you to build your house, to buy everything, to do this thing, as you know, in South Sudan life is hard. So it was really a bad experience and really affected us.
Tabi urges the government to respond to humanitarian disasters across the country. She says the Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs should educate communities affected by floods how to tackle potential humanitarian disasters.
We have a lot of disasters that can happen, and people are not always ready for it. So it's good the government should always be prepared for disasters, not disaster to come and they are like, we don't have resources to do these things.
Albino Akolatak, South Sudan Minister of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management, says his ministry lacks sufficient funds to respond to the long-term humanitarian crisis in the country.
There is no long-term funding for disaster risk activities. That's one of the issues that we are now struggling to have a long-term funding, because for us to build this system in place, we need long-term funding for these activities. There are too many actors practicing disaster risk reduction with no or limited coordination, which creates implementation constraints.
South Sudan Vice President in charge of the government gender and youth cluster, Rebecca Nyandeng, says the government needs to involve local communities in any projects aimed at addressing humanitarian crises across the country.
Disaster response need to involve local people. Communities have a wealth of valuable skill and knowledge to offer. Working closely with local people helps them develop the skills to handle future disasters.
Nyadeng says psychosocial support should be included in programs geared towards healthy and resilient communities.
We need to invest in trauma healing programs, provide counseling services, and raise awareness about mental health support, which are critical steps toward building more robust and resilient communities. Through this holistic approach, we can create a foundation for long-term disaster risk reduction.
Titus Osulade, the Deputy Resident Representative of the United Nations Development Programme, or UNDP, says the country is in the process of establishing an early warning system to detect climate focus. He says the system would help farmers make decisions on their agricultural projects.
The country will be able to undertake accurate and reliable climate forecasts and predictions in any area in the country to better guide and inform farmers adopting climate-smart agriculture of the changing rainfall and climate patterns. It will also be able to inform humanitarian development agencies of potential disaster risks and events in order to better inform prevention, mitigation, and preparedness measures.
October 13 is the International Day for Disaster Risk Reduction. South Sudan Ministry of Humanitarian Affairs and Disaster Management commemorated the day 2 weeks later under the theme Fighting Inequality for a Resilient Future. For VOA News, I am Viola Elias in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Coming up on South Sudan in Focus, the Biden administration gets ready to drop four American or African countries from a trade program. Stay tuned. You're listening to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. Some citizens of South Sudan say the revised national land policy recently approved by the country's Council of Ministers has certain loopholes in it which could lead to potential land disputes in central Equatoria State and other areas of the country. Dimo Silva Aurelio has more for VOA from Juba.
The Council of Ministers approved a national land policy last week aimed at establishing a framework for allocating and protecting individual and collective land rights in South Sudan. Chapter 2, Article 7, Subsection 1 of the revised policy states that all land is owned by the people of South Sudan and its usage shall be regulated by the government. Reacting on the consultative workshop in Juba Tuesday to discuss the revised land policy, Obor Peter Severino said the land policy passed by the Council of Ministers could cause conflicts.
Land belongs to the community, is more close. But land belongs to the people, is more open. So meaning anyone or any other South Sudanese or maybe any institution at one point can decide to go against the law and says the land belongs to the people. So we are much worried that this is likely to increase the rate of land grabbing. And as we are aware, land has caused a lot of insecurity matters in Juba. This year alone,
First Vice President Riek Machar Teny says land disputes have been a major cause of communal violence, especially in the greater Equatorial region between farmers and cattle keepers. Machar says more consultations on the issue of land ownership should be carried out.
During the CPA, we introduced this concept that land belongs to people. It was not abstract. It's the truth of the matter. The land belongs to the community. And I want to quote from the land just one part of the introduction, the opening of the introduction of the land policy. It says, land is crucial in the struggle for political independence, social justice and welfare of the people of South Sudan.
Timo Olkonen, the European Union ambassador to South Sudan, says wider consultation on Land Act and the local government provisions requires wider opinion for an inclusive constitutional-making process.
This review process has the potential to significantly reduce disputes regarding local governance and land rights, contributing further to social cohesion and reduce tensions countrywide. It can lead to a strengthened ability for communities, especially most vulnerable people, including women and girls, including IDPs and returnees, to claim and fully exercise their rights.
He says land policy should include rights for women to acquire land and have a voice on land issues. South Sudan's Justice Minister Madol Arol says last week's move by the Council of Ministers does not stop discussions on what needs to be done during the review process.
It was only last week that the government of South Sudan in the Council of Ministers approved the land policy. We need to be mindful on what's the position of this plan policy with regards to the sort of review we are contemplating and trying to act on today.
Stakeholders at Tuesday's consultative meeting in Juba agreed that land issues in South Sudan is one of the major causes of intercommunal conflict. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio in Juba.
U.S. President Joe Biden recently indicated he plans to expel Uganda, Gabon, Niger, and the Central African Republic from a special U.S.-Africa trade program called the Africa Growth and Opportunity Act, or AGOA. Ambassador J. Peter Pham, distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council and a former U.S. special envoy to the Sahel region, tells me that the four countries will likely be expelled from AGOA for one or more reasons.
When Congress legislated and created the African Growth and Opportunity Act, the AGOA system of trade preferences for sub-Saharan Africa, there are three criteria written into the law with broad bipartisan support. One was the country had to be making reforms toward a market economy, liberalization, and transparency. Secondly, the country had to respect the rule of law, including, obviously, not having unconstitutional changes of government and not carrying out human rights abuses. And thirdly, the country should not be undermining U.S. foreign policy interests or national security. So those are the three criteria for eligibility. This is not a trade agreement. This is a trade concession of benefits to African countries, allowing them to export goods without tariffs. And that gives them a heads-up advantage. In Gabon and Niger, because they had unconstitutional changes of government. It goes with the recognition by the State Department that their coups have taken place. Central African Republic, the human rights abuses, including those carried out with the implicit and sometimes explicit sanction of the government by the Wagner group and other Russian mercenaries, is well documented by human rights groups. And then Uganda, following upon the advisory put out by the State Department about its anti-LGBTQ plus legislation that was signed into law earlier this year.
A law that imposes the death penalty on people found guilty of engaging in certain same-sex acts.
Yeah.
But this is a big deal for these countries, right, to be dropped from AGOA?
Well, in absolute terms, perhaps not as big, but certainly in reputational terms, it's a big deal. For example, the Central African Republic exports to the United States less than $1 million worth of goods a year. So really, even with tariffs slapped on, I don't think it's going to affect the surrounding area in terms of international trade. Likewise, the Gabon, perhaps bigger. I mean, there we're dealing with last year about $220 million worth of exports to the U.S. Niger, again, large sum, but not that big, about $73 million. Uganda, it's up there with Gabon, about $174 million worth of exports to the U.S. But I think for these countries, much more importantly, is the signal it sends that you've been removed from a system of trade preferences. You're somehow, no longer have the good housekeeping seal of approval.
Some of the countries that we have not talked about were expelled before. Burkina Faso, Mali, Guinea. Why were they dropped?
Unconstitutional changes of government. They all had coups, which, raises an interesting issue. Congress and AGOA was passed back in the Clinton administration, renewed in the Bush administration, renewed in the Obama administration, and in fact is up for renewal next year in the U.S. Congress with wide, broad bipartisan support. But Congress had a consensus on three criteria: market reforms, not engage a rule of law, and certainly not having coups. But the third one is the one that I think bears a bit of looking at, which is the one that Congress insists that the countries that benefit from this should not do anything that undermines U.S. foreign policy interests or national security.
That is Ambassador J. Peter Pham, distinguished fellow at the Atlantic Council's Africa Center. He's also a former U.S. special envoy to the Sahel region of Africa. He was speaking with me here in Washington this past hour. Israel's four-day ground assault on Gaza has killed thousands of Palestinians in response to the Hamas militant group's stunning October 7th attack on civilians that left about 1,400 Israelis dead. But as Israel brings the fight to this tiny, crowded strip of land, officials from Washington, Moscow, Tehran, and Ankara are weighing in. VOA's Anita Powell has details from the White House.
The White House says it welcomes the limited flow of humanitarian aid and the restoration of telecommunications in Gaza as Israel continues its ground offensive on the enclave in response to militant group Hamas's October 7th attack. The Biden administration also is repeating its warning to armed groups to stay out of the fight. John Kirby is director of strategic communications for the National Security Council.
Our message to any actor seeking to exploit this conflict is don't do it. And as you all know, we have strengthened our force posture in the region. We're continually watching to make sure that any actor who might be tempted to jump in here knows that we will take very seriously our national security interests in the region, not to mention our obligation to protect our troops and our facilities that are going after ISIS in places like Iraq and Syria.
But this conflict is also exploding in the court of public opinion. Hundreds of people stormed an airport in Russia's Dagestan region over the weekend, shouting anti-Semitic slurs over the arrival of a flight from Tel Aviv. Russia's president blamed the events on foreign interference, a move Kirby dismissed as classic Russian rhetoric. Here's Russian President Vladimir Putin. The events in Makhachkala last night were inspired, including through social networks, not least from the territory of Ukraine, by the agents of Western intelligence services, Putin said.
The events in Makhachkala last night were inspired, including through social networks, not least from the territory of Ukraine, by the agents of Western intelligence services.
And Turkey's president has dug in on his disagreement with the U.S.'s classification of Hamas as a terror group and has shifted blame elsewhere. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan. The West has the biggest responsibility for the massacre in Gaza, he said.
The West has the biggest responsibility for the massacre in Gaza.
Iranian officials have piled on as well. That nation's foreign minister took to the rostrum at the United Nations last week to outline their view. Iranians have also protested on the streets. Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian.
It has been 3 weeks that we have been witness to the war crimes and genocide of the occupying Israeli regime in Gaza and the West Bank of Palestine. The United States and several European countries have sided with the occupying regime of Israel. Without observing the UN Charter and international law,
Kirby says the White House believes there's a fine line between disagreement and discord, and says the administration is vigilant over outbreaks of anti-Semitism.
No, we believe in the right of peaceful protest, even if it's, you know, espousing ideas we don't agree with. But we don't, nobody wants to see peaceful protest turn violent or turn dangerous the way that this mob activity did in Dagestan yesterday. So it's of concern, and it's something that we'll continue to talk about with our allies and partners.
But it's also something that increasingly the White House is facing at home, as protests, many supportive Palestinians and critical of Israel, have bubbled up at major U.S. universities in recent weeks. Anita Powell, VOA News, the White House.
That's our show for this Tuesday. We invite you to check out voaafrica.com for all your favorite programs and updates. If you missed the broadcast, head over to www.voaafrica.com/South Sudan. We now leave you with the song Labi Amaro. I'm your host, Carol Van Damme in Washington. On behalf of our engineer, Cornelius Tenor, and producer, Kwame Afori, thanks for being here. We'll see you back here tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.
Love you, Amaro.